Okay, I am Teresa Beth Garner. I've been in youth ministry for a long time, and my husband began in youth ministry 25 years ago, and so we've been doing this youth thing for a while. People wonder how you can do this and be as old as we are. Well, you just get older while you do this. But we love teenagers, and so this particular workshop today, we are actually, if you look on the handout that I've given to you, we have some questions that we're going to kind of answer, and then we'll kind of get into some interaction. So we're actually talking to people, whether you're a children's pastor or a youth pastor or a pastor, or if you are working with youth in some way. We are trying to bridge this gap between the church and youth ministry, because they have become separate entities at times, instead of being one and the same. And we must get back to that. And we're going to kind of talk about the history of that, and then how we're going to move forward, okay? So that's kind of how we're going to proceed. I am now a lead youth ministry professor here at Olivet Nazarene University. We've been in practical ministry for many years, but the last 2 years we moved here to the Olivet campus, and I am a professor, and my husband is, again, a youth pastor. After being an executive pastor in a church for 10 years, he went back into youth ministry. So it has been quite the reversal of roles and change up everything in our lives' time. So we're enjoying this time, but we're also, I'm in school at Fuller Theological Seminary. I'm studying youth, family, and culture. I'm getting my doctor of ministry degree, and it has just opened a whole new world for me, and I feel like we just need to understand a little bit more of the mechanics of what's going on, what has gone on, and how we need to move forward from this point. What's a church to do? How is a church to respond to youth ministry and to embrace and engage youth ministry? So I'd like to start with prayer, and then we will start moving. God, thank you so much for the beautiful day that we have. Thank you for the moments that we have to engage with our speakers and each other and your word, and just to be with you. Help us unplug a little bit, to just take time to rest if we need to rest, or to engage when we need to engage. Thank you, and I pray that you would be honored in all that we say and do today. In Jesus' name we pray, amen. Okay. So I have some questions, and I may have some time where you can talk to each other about some of the answers. And if you guys just came in and you need handouts, they are right here. I'll put them over here. And do you need one? Here you go. So the first question, how did we get, you're welcome. How did we get to where we are now? Okay. So I'm going to give you like this much of historical background. There are handouts right there. I'm going to give you this much historical background, and then we're going to move on, okay? Because this can be a little tedious, but I just want you to understand kind of where we've come from and where we're heading. So in the late 1700s and 1800s, we're not good, if this is not like a huge history lesson, but hang with me. The youth apprenticeships that youth had with adults started fading. We move into a time where families begin moving to cities. And this is in the 1800s, we've invented high school now. We are now saying that high school is going to be mandatory, because students are getting into trouble because they are not in apprenticeships anymore. Now, instead of being with families all day long and with adults that are from their own faith backgrounds and communities, they are now with all sorts of people, and no one knows where they are and what they're doing, okay? So this is 1800s, 1900s, and they are just starting to go to high school. We look at families being separated from families and neighbors that held the same values and ideals, okay? So we're everything's changing here. Then you have students spending more and more time away from family and parents. Then there are grave concerns about wayward teens. And then we have churches kind of adopting this generation gap terminology, that kids don't want to be with their parents, that kids don't want to be with adults, that students don't want to have anything to do with people who are older than them. What do the studies show us now? Every study we look at, every single study we look at, what does it say? Number one person in their life to influence them is parents. Outside of that, the next building block is people who are not related to them, but are adults that are a part of their worlds. All of this is, it's huge. We're looking at this and going, why did we jump on this generation gap bandwagon? Well, when did that start? Well, let's look back to a huge phenomenon that happened in the 60s. What was it? Oh, that was awesome. Yes, that was a great place to kind of bridge the gap. But there was something that happened in the world, in the country, Woodstock. Do you remember that? Woodstock was a time when all of the young people got together. No rules, right? Free for all, generation gap. It was happening, and the church jumped on this bandwagon of teens just need to be on their own. And we almost set up kind of a babysitting service. Let's have our kids over here, not involved in the church, because the parents need a break. The students need a break. Well, I really think that we've got to deal with some of the effects of that now, and we're going to be talking about that a little bit. So let's look back at what had been the charge of the family. Let's look back at Deuteronomy. What was the charge? The charge was to the families to say the Shema, to tie the laws of God around their hands and hearts and minds and everything, to walk with their kids every single day along the road while they're working, whatever they're doing, to put this on their hearts. And all of a sudden, now, from where we were, if you look at Deuteronomy 6, 1 through 9, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands. Bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. Guess what? What has happened in the last 40 years of youth ministry? We have seen this trend, and it is that we have silos in our churches. We have church, children's ministry, youth ministry, women's ministry, men's ministry, when in fact it should all be one and the same. And we have so many things going, we're missing each other, right? We have so many programs, so many things happening, that we just go, 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 go. There is no time to be the church. We are all the church. But how does a church and a body of young people, how does a church and a body of children, how do we become one? How do we bring it all back together under the same roof? How do we make it a place where, yes, we have specialized in youth ministry, we have specialized in children's ministry, but as a whole, we are a church together as one. Those are kind of the problems I think I see with where we've been and where we're heading. So we know that students look to parents and the church for a faith that sticks. We know. We have just finished a ton of studies. If you look at any of these books, and I don't have the Sticky Faith book with me, but if you look at any of these books, we are looking at, when we look at Elkind, he's a psychologist who is looking at what has happened to the family. We don't have parents that are visible to their children very much of the time. We're always plugged into something, right? We're not talking to each other. We're not engaging with one another. We're looking at all of this, souls in transition, soul searching, Almost Christian. These books are all talking about the surveys that were done between 2003 and 2005. These are all listed on your paper at the bottom, telling you the books that we're taking some of this stuff from, where we see what's happened over the last several years, where the modern family has now become the postmodern family, has now become what we're not really sure of, because what's happening is everybody's splintering. And we're atomizing. Everybody is pulled in 500 different directions, including our pastors, including our youth pastors, including their families. We are not understanding what it is to be whole people. And as a church, our students take so much from what they see in other adults and in their pastors and in their youth pastors, in the people that care for them. They watch you. They watch me. They want to know how to live this holiness life. What does it mean? And they're watching us. So all of that to say, how can we create an atmosphere that encounters or encourages sticky faith? When I say sticky faith, I mean a faith that once these teenagers are grown up and they're 18 and they're heading out the door to go to college and where else, that they actually, their faith is still going to stick. How do we encourage this? How do we engage them in a way that they're not done with the church when they're 18? How do we do it? I think we have to understand what it is to be a teenager. We cannot place on them the feelings that some of us had in the 60s that were alive. Some of you were not alive in the 60s. Sad. But 60s and 70s were, you know, the rebellious generation, the wayward generation. You know what? These studies that we've just seen the results to, do you know that the vast majority of teenagers in America, guess what they identify as in the study of religious lives of young people? What do you think they identify as? The vast majority of teenagers, they identify as Christian. They themselves, out of 3,500 respondents, say, I'm a Christian. Who knew? Why is that such a surprise to so many of us? I can't even speak about it because it's astounding. Who knew? That's what we're hearing from them. They identify as Christian, but they also talk about their congregations. It's a little scary. They talk about their parents. It's a little scary. Many times we see that the faith of the children, once they're grown, is the faith of their parents, the faith of their church. How do we engage them? So what does your church feel like to teenagers? What do you think your church feels like to teenagers? It could be a big church, a small church. It could be in between. What does your church feel like to teenagers? Is it a place where the adults teach the teenagers? Or is it a place where there is a mentoring system that goes both ways? How does it feel? What do you think it looks like? Take just a minute. If you were a teenager and you were coming to your church, how does it feel? And then someone tell me, why does feeling matter? Anybody?
I think in our church you're seeing transition right now.
Okay.
I mean, going from an old model of this is what it is, you do what I'm telling you.
Yes, to, yes.
Instead of asking what they see and what they
feel. Yes. So instead of top-down leadership.
Instead of talking at them.
Yes.
Listening to them.
Engaging them. Yes, fantastic. Fantastic. Yes.
When I started, we had a really, really small youth group. And the first thing I did was gave them these sheets that asked about who they were. Like your favorite candy, like all kinds of dumb stuff.
Sure.
But every one of them was like, why are we doing this? Why do you want to know all this stuff? Like,
yes.
Why do you care about what your cake we like?
Yes, yes.
And it hit me, like, when you just asked how do you feel, how I would feel being able to fill that out is that, like, somebody has to care enough to have these.
Yes.
So I think that would be, like, something for me. I think the little things that we do as youth pastors and in youth ministry, that little stuff.
Yes.
Thinking of those feelings is so important.
What we know of 5th through 8th graders right now is this. Their brains are changing so quickly. One of my favorite studies right now is in neuroscience. And I am not a scientist by all means. I know enough just to be dangerous. But when it comes to understanding what's happening with these 5th through 8th grade brains, it's really fascinating. What's happening is they are purging all the things that they're not using from their brains. They're leaving, right? And this white matter, it is becoming more prominent in the brain, which actually makes the synapses work better and information travels faster, and they're starting to get more information in their brains. It's really cool. I know you're probably going, she's off of her rocker. But it's so exciting to me because I'm seeing what's happening here in these 5th through 8th grade kids. Okay, so we've already taught them a lot of things about the Bible, but at 5th through 8th grade, sometimes we kind of wonder if the brains are working. Well, they are, but what they need from you is the feeling safe part. Because the brain is not working like it used to, and it's not working like it's going to, but right now they're in transition.
Well, like
their brains are transitioning.
And that's something that I've used with youth. It's kind of like that with tiles. I call it tiles.
Okay.
I said, and I explained to him, I says, okay, you've got good tiles and you got bad tiles.
Yes. Yes.
I said, so as we take a bad tile out, we need to put a good
tile in.
Because so if we leave it open, then the bad tile is going to go back and it's going to bring more bad tiles.
Okay, so what we're saying to them actually is use it or lose it.
Exactly.
Either you use what you have been taught about Jesus, the church, either you use it and it becomes a part of your life, or you lose it and it's gone. Because we're purging, the brain is purging so much stuff that we've had for so long, and new stuff is coming. We have this amazing opportunity to help them understand who Jesus is in a new way, a refreshing way, and they have a way of helping us understand as well. So fifth through eighth grade, we're looking at just reinforcing kind of what they've already learned, but helping them understand it in different ways, maybe. But reinforcing what they've already learned. Then we get through your 9th through 12th grade, and we have abstract thinking happening. For the first time, they might be able to understand a little more about how you feel, or how you feel. And the feeling word is a big deal. They might actually put themselves in your place and see who you are and try to understand why you think the way you think. Those types of things are happening. So then we have a lot of new information happening in their brains as well. But when we look at when they're doubting, when they're questioning, let's also ask that question. Is your church a safe place to doubt? Is your church a safe place to question? Is your church a place that will shut them down right now? You can't do that. You can't question that. No way. Or is your church saying, bring it on. Bring it on. There is nothing that you can scare me so bad that I'm going to run away from you. I will stick with you. Bring on the questions. Bring on the doubt. And if they feel safe enough to engage in that way, you have a huge piece of the puzzle that's in place that is powerful for them, because that's part of their maturing process. That's part of them understanding how to use it as not to lose it. If I can question this and still be okay, if I can doubt and know that you're with me, oh, that brings relief, because there are some boundaries there. There are some parameters there that might be helpful and safe for me because you're there, you're with me. You're not saying, no, you can't do that. Do you encourage critical thought? Do you shut it down? Does the church invest in intergenerational mutual mentoring? And is God big enough and is he small enough both? Is he big enough? Is he small enough for them to encounter in the church? These are questions that I'm asking you to think about in your churches. And then, are there people old and young who are open, vulnerable, and honest with their lives? One of the things I want to challenge you with, and then I want to kind of ask you to talk to each other just for a little bit. This is what I do in class here at Olivet. Many times I will ask them a question and have them answer it together with four of you, just to kind of give some input. You need to hear from other people, not just me. And we need to hear from each other. But when we're looking at creating an atmosphere that encourages sticky faith, a faith that will stay after 18 years of age or 19 years of age, do you have people who are open enough with their lives? Are you open enough with your failures that they feel that you can be vulnerable with them? When we are constantly guarding our stuff so that others don't realize that we may not have it all together, or that we may not have passed through that valley before, then we cannot share our story. Do you know the difference between a successful teenager who makes it out alive, right? and who actually becomes a successful adult, and someone who does not become a successful, mature adult? Most of the time, it goes back to being able to narrate their story. If they cannot narrate their story, no matter how awful and horrid it may be, they will stay stuck in the remnants of that story, and they may not be able to get out. We just talked about this at lunch today. We were with another couple who has run Celebrate Recovery for several years. And we ran a program that came from Celebrate Recovery. It was called Life Hurts, God Heals. It's now called The Landing. We still feel like Life Hurts, God Heals was something that was a little more easy to use. But we would take our students and we would ask them, come to this place where you're safe. Share your story with one mentor, and that mentor would be older than them. And then share your stories together. Let them share their story with you. And we did that every year, and it was a powerful place where stories were being shared, stories of vulnerability, stories that were narrated by the person in the story that's first person. They are telling their stories, and they're able to share it without fear. And we just saw the healing that that brought, and the cohesiveness then of your congregation, because your adults are hearing the stories of students, but your students are hearing the stories of adults. And they're hearing about redemption for the first time. They're hearing about freedom from the past for the first time. And they are seeing what's happening with the adults right there in that church. I don't think it has to be a big church, a large church, a small church, a medium church. It has to be an authentic church. A place where you can have authentic conversations, organic conversations about who I am, who I used to be, who I want to be. Man, those things get pretty powerful. So right now, what I want you to do, I want you to find four people, if you can, four people that can get together. Like if you four can somehow maneuver or then you five can get together if you want, and then you two can talk or whatever. But I want you to ask yourself this question. Your church, where you minister, your church, how safe do you feel your students feel in your church? How safe, and how safe do you feel as an adult when students are part of your church? How safe do you feel? I want you to kind of toy with that a little bit, okay? I'll give you about 3 minutes, go. How safe do your kids feel when they walk into your church? Yes.
I think so. I'm trying to stop. Hold on. How do you think I do this? Hold on.
I have no idea.
Stop recording.
Oh, yes.
Save recording. Yes.